even if they are launched from space.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has put the price tag as high as $500 billion. I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Dismantling the Master's Clock. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Blues for Malcolm by Terence Blanchard. And we play that as we continue to commemorate Malcolm X's 100th birthday, which was on May 19. First, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for supporting Africa Now and WPFW during our recently concluded spring membership drive. Because of your continued unwavering support, WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Thank you for being in solidarity with our mission to build a better world one broadcast at a time. Today, Africa Now features a discussion on race, colonial time, and black freedom with artist, culture producer, writer, community activist, and lawyer Rashida Phillips of Black Quantum Futurism. Among many things, the conversation between Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope and Rashida Phillips explores how space and time are intertwined in African peoples worldwide. Also, what tools to use to actualize theories and more. Rashida Phillips is the founder of the Afrofuturist Affair, founding member of Metropolitan Queer Speculative Fiction Collective, co-founder of Black Quantum Futurism, co-creator of the Community Futures Lab, and creator of the Black Women Temporal Portal, the Time Zone Protocols, and Black Time Belt Projects. Rashida Phillips' books include Dismantling the Master's Clock on Race, Space, and Time, The Telescoping Effect, and Recurrence, Plot, and Other Time Travel Tales. Rashida Phillips currently serves as Director of Housing Futures and Land Justice at Policy Link. Here is a discussion between Rashida Phillips and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope.
Thank you for taking the time to actually join us today to have this conversation. Tom is in quotes here, to have this conversation, you know, about your recently published work, Dismantling the Master's Clock. There are a lot of themes, there are a lot of ideas, there are a lot of concepts that resonate with me personally, but also with the work that I attempt to do outside of academia, which is rooted in the liberation of our people from seen and unseen barriers and ways within which, as you term it, the master's clock attempts to arrest us, and how we view ourselves, how we evolve as a people towards, you know, the liberation. So this, you know, again, thank you for being here and engaging in this conversation today.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to unpack these themes from different perspectives with different folks. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you have a wide range. It's very deep and very wide. And I appreciate, you know, the conceptualizations. And one of the things that jumped out to me very early in this book is this notion of defining or utilizing or taking, you know, this idea of time space and putting it at a granular level, taking it outside of the abstract conceptualizations that usually is associated with physics, quantum physics, you know, those type of things. Because we as African people and African descended people have always had a very clear understanding of those concepts. You know, I appreciate, you know, that that use of space time as the lived realities of people. Could you talk a little bit more about that, you know, that use and your attempt to make real concepts and ideas, particularly in quantum physics, time, all of those things, and make it real for us in the history of African people, African descended people, wherever we are?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things, as you noted, that I talk about when I name space-time, I talk about it both in that sort of cosmic level and then bring it back down to the everyday level, right? In terms of like, space for us is both out there, it's both within us, it's both, you know, occupying what's around us, it's our environment, it's all these different things. But as you said, it often gets abstracted for things that are, you know, for things that are often outside of our control. And so like we as everyday people don't feel like we have the ability to think about space in the sort of like, how does space impact us on an everyday basis? Or like we don't have access, like the billionaires, to be able to go out to space. So what does that mean in terms of our relationship to it, in terms of something that's so abstract and out there? But as you noted, for traditions of African across the continent, across the diaspora, within our everyday traditions, our spiritual traditions, our ritual traditions, all those things are intertwined also, right? Like it's not just like the spirituality is set aside for a Sunday. And then, you know, on Sunday, that's when we activate thinking about the spirit, right? Like it's a part of everything that we do. And so when you say space-time and you're talking about it in the Black context, it takes on those layers. It takes on those various nuances. It takes on this like sort of nesting within emergent quality of like, again, space is what's within us. Who's to say that what's within us is different than what's in the cosmos? It's not, right? Like, and even physics says that, right? Like the stuff of stars is the stuff that we're made of. And I think in Black and African traditions, at least from my research, right? Like that's taken very seriously. That's taken, again, that's a part of how we move through reality, knowing that we are entangled with the cosmos, and that's what's in the cosmos is happening here on Earth in various different types of ways and unfolding in different ways. So yeah, that's kind of how I thought about it. And, you know, also I think physics tells us, some of the traditions of physics and theories of physics, like relativity, tells us that space-time is combined. And again, like we don't have to talk about it in physics terms to understand that often how we think about time is entangled with space. And we think about space often, but we abstract it from time when there is this sort of entanglement. And so I talk about it a lot in the book in terms of like me being a housing attorney in my practice and thinking about physical space and how that's wrapped up in time and memory and access, access to the future, access to history, those sorts of things.
And so the spatiality and this notion that we take it seriously is very important, because the architecture, the language, the way that even when we're talking about in a historical context, the way that we understood, or our ancestors understood, how to describe their realities beyond the plantation, beyond the spatiality, and imagine and think about worlds that, you know, you talk about this notion of future, you talk about temporality, this idea of time being something that includes the past, present, and future at once, right? How does this particular work fit into the overall objective of the genealogy of your other work? Because this is a culmination, as I'm reading it, and you also state in your works too, is it's a culmination of a series of projects and thinking about this in the context of your work as around housing, as an advocate, but also as an artist, as a cultural worker. Because you could talk about, you know, those different things, the intellectual influences, free flow, dive in anywhere, and we'll come to some point.
I often talk about, and I speak about this in a book, sort of my non-linearity, my own non-linear path into this work, into the work broadly as you named a cultural creation, an advocate, all of those things. And part of why I think that has benefited me is because I have never had a like straightforward, like you have to do things this way and that way. Of course, I've been like affected by that and indoctrinated by like, okay, if I'm going to claim to be an artist and be doing these international exhibitions, maybe I should have went to school for this, or maybe I should know how to work this particular type of program. I didn't have the ability to do that because I talk about this in the book. I was a young parent. I had my kid at an early age, at the age of 14. And for me, the first part of my life was really like, how do I maintain a stable household so that my child doesn't fall back into the same cycle, you know, that I've been exposed to? How do I shift that trajectory for my own child? And so like my mind was very much focused, even though I've always been an artist at heart, always thought about these things, always thought about sort of time and time travel and sort of like breaking that down. I didn't really have a chance to sort of intellectually engage with those things until I felt settled in my career. But I think now like that's been a benefit for me to be able to come across it at the time when it was supposed to happen, in terms of like, as I talk about time in a book, things coming together when they're supposed to, like synchronizing, you know, manifesting, those sorts of things that are, again, embedded in our traditions as Black folks in terms of how we think about reality. And so like when I take those things seriously, I'm like, okay, I was on the path I was meant to be. And so, yeah, as a person who started my career first as a lawyer before I even really thought about art or like making it something that I could like produce or be a cultural producer, I was thinking about justice. I was thinking about fairness. I was thinking about Black people and how we access these futures that have been promised to us and stripped from us in these particular ways. And then coming across Afrofuturism after that, I was like, oh, I can apply this to how I think about justice and housing and all these different things. And so, yeah, it's just been very nonlinear, but in a way that like is true to the realities that I'm speaking of, that like things are messier than they appear on the surface. And like chaos, you know, chaos starts to unfold and get bigger the more you zoom in on it. And so, yeah, like I feel like my own life is a microcosm of like being able to think about how these theories play out in reality, which is always why I'm like thinking about what tools can I share with other folks? What tools can I build around like mapping? Because I know that this isn't like an easy way of like thinking either, especially if you're not from these places where like these traditions are more present, where they've been able to hold on to them. And like, you know, in the American context, it's been so convoluted for us. But that's not to say that, right, like we haven't built our own traditions. We haven't created things from nothing, from the things that we had to keep and bury and dig up again. So yeah, just being able to like tap into that and to hold this reality alongside of or in entanglement with like being a housing justice person or being a parent. And yeah, it's just lifing. So I think about it like that. And I think about all of this as like a life practice as opposed to like an artistic practice or a legal practice, right? Like for me, it's all entangled in like how I need to show up as a person on this earth, how I need to be in community with other folks, and how time is even created, or space is even created, is created, from my opinion, with community, within community. Mm. So yeah, that's how I enter into this.
And this identity is formed as well. You talk about the notions of identity. You talk about, and this is all in the book, you know, the ideas of how dismantling, because we talk about dismantling the master's clock. So you define the master's clock in a particular way that gives the reader a very clear way of understanding how you are thinking about oppressed people tell time versus those who are trying to oppress people understand time. Yes. You talk about that in a number of chapters, and you're kind of mapping that out. You're detangling that or delinking that, decolonizing that. And this conversation around time is a very important. And as someone who thinks about freedom, thinks about Maroon communities, thinks about the way the Maroons understood spatiality in the context of time. Are they thinking that home is this space or something beyond? Just so I'm thinking about, you know, that. Could you talk about a little bit more about, you know, choosing the title, Dismantling the Master's Clock? Again, this goes specifically to the master's house. I'm sorry. I'm thinking to Audre Lorde.
Yeah, her essay.
Her essay, right? Everybody get it, right? So that's very clear. Draw that parallel and talk about why it was important for you to approach the decolonization process in this particular way of time.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's a big question. So much of when I was doing research before the book, before any of these things happened around time, and my curiosity around it, it was very evident to me that time was about power and was entangled in power in all these different ways. When I talk about the master's clock, you know, I'm talking about it obviously metaphorically and in its sort of colonialist context, but also talking about quite literally there being a quite literal master's clock, right? And like that even the way time is constructed, it is constructed in mind with a master holding time and defining time for other people. So like whether you're looking at Christian tradition, whether you're looking at, you know, whatever tradition, Western tradition of time you want to think about, there's always this sort of master in mind and sort of holding what time is and it's sort of like universe or whatever, on up to, again, that being physically manifested in material cultures of time, of clocks, of watches, all of those things. You look at the origins of them, you look at even the etymology of the words, right? They are very much intertwined with this power dynamic around a master and someone who is enslaved to this time, right? Like we have no creative control. We have no control whatsoever over the future, over the past, right? Like we are stuck in time as slaves to time, essentially. You know, again, what seems like it's metaphorical for us, it takes on a very different and very literal meaning as subjects of oppression, enslavement, and time itself through the Western version of what time is. So yeah, dismantling the master's clock was just making that very real and very evident. When we look at clocks, just like when we look at maps, all sorts of assumptions have to be made in order for us to be able to move quickly through the world. And like, you know, I talk about this like, time is obviously, it has a utility. It's an organizing tool. It allows us to be able to not have trains crash into each other and to be able to show up in relatively the same, you know, sort of time period. But beyond that, it has significant implications for who we are, how we live, how we are able to make it into the so-called future, how we're able to take care of our families, how we're able to thrive, how we're able to keep our own timelines. Like it has so many implications because of those origins. So yeah, I think it was like both the literal, it was of course the sort of connection to Audre Lorde and how she talks about, you know, not using the same tools. And I think that's right, right? Like that's also what I'm calling to, that we cannot use these same mechanisms of time that have enslaved us in other ways, physically and metaphorically and psychologically and ontologically and all these other things, right? We can't continue to use that same time. We can't continue to read the clock in the same way. We have our own time. We have our own tools. We have our own ways of creating space-time. So yeah, that's sort of the connections being made for me. And I think others have probably found some other ways in which it resonates differently for them. So
the continuities in your approach is very important because, as you say, you know, people are thinking or beginning to think about the colonization of time or the use of the time or the redefinition of time to further enslave, but also use as a tool of repression in multiple levels, what I would call, you know, obviously the material and non-materiality of our realities, of our existence. The elements that you kind of use, when I'm talking specifically about the diasporic and African conceptualizations of time that you use, you talk about Sankofa, you look at Zora Neale Hurston, you also Mobiti, you look at those. Could you talk a little bit about how those African and diasporic conceptualizations specifically fit into how you're thinking about your work here, but also as you're extending this to the community and the other social justice practices that you're engaged in?
I feel like the way I'm thinking about it in the context of the continent that I call home is how time can be a tool of liberation, how it gets us beyond equity, beyond justice, beyond these sort of like very ephemeral sorts of things to a place where we can move the needle towards true liberation as a people. And I find that, again, the sort of tools that folks have used and noticed and sort of thought about in terms of like our culture. Yeah, they're just super powerful and that they've been buried. They've been erased as sort of ways of getting to liberation. So one chapter, for example, I talk a lot about Harriet Tubman and how Harriet Tubman used, you know, sort of water and water, what looks to me like water divination, to be able to, or just like reading her natural environment, and that was ultimately temporal. So like being able to think about how to use the cover of darkness and the nighttime to move, and to how to use silence and quietness at a certain time of day, or stillness to be able to move to liberation. And yeah, those are just very Black things, right? Like those are just very, very rooted in very specific context that, you know, no one else should be able to like access or like read the code in the way that we do, right? Because these things aren't legible to people outside of those who have had a specific struggle. And I also try to not be like, oh, it's essentialist in terms of like biology, like if you're a Black person with a certain biology, right? Like that's not at all what I'm getting at. Like I'm very much getting at this very cultural, historical, futuristic experience that we as Black people are bound by because of the things that we have in common together. So yeah, being able to like draw on those things, I find very relevant to the things that I deal with as a housing policy person, particularly in my work. I'm looking at how we build strategies around reparative justice in our country, particularly for Black communities, Indigenous communities that have suffered specific harms. So like folks in Tulsa, right, who are trying to achieve and access reparative justice for the race massacre in Tulsa, Africatown, Alabama, where, you know, the last illegal slave ship, I mean, they're all illegal, right, but the last slave ship, Clotilda, landed, and where the people there after that were able to form their own town, Black town and settlement that is still stands today, but that is at risk, right? And so how do we bring these temporal tools to connect what is supposed to be the past to the present, to a future where we can thrive, is really my concern with how we utilize these tools. And yeah, I think that does go beyond the American context, and it does extend into global context. And I talk about this in a book around like time zones and how time zones impact us around the world, and how like the decision around what time zones we would have was made by a handful of white men in a room that gathered, you know, and then a couple months later, some of those white men were at the Berlin conference dividing up Africa, right? Like, so again, the power dynamics, the severe and deep power dynamics that are embedded in simply what we look on our watch and see on the time, right? Like that, what we see is not just what's there. It's all of these things behind it that dictate our lives in different ways. So yeah, the conversation definitely extends beyond America. And, you know, I've had really amazing conversations with folks around the world around like how time zones impact them and how, and their own histories of colonization in their own communities, and the similarities, you know, so.
I wanted to pull on a strand of thought, because this notion or this idea of restorative justice related to the temporality of wrongs in the past. You know, I'm just thinking about reparations. I'm thinking about, you know, the idea of when questions of restorative justice are brought to questions around accountability, there's always this question, well, that wasn't me, that wasn't my people, right? When you're bringing them to the lineage of those who are still benefiting from this long system of, you know, chattel slavery and Jim Crow, and as someone, you know, as someone who's a lawyer, right, who's thinking about the legality, again, you write about this, you just put into chapters to talk about, talk a little bit more about that, the use of language in a legal sense and how that can extend, expand, but also create barriers mm-hmm. to how restorative or repair is understood in the context of past wrongs. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, I know it's a big question. It made perfect sense. Okay, good. It's a hard question, but yeah, it makes good sense. Yeah, I, you know, and I love the question because it's very heady also for me as a person who's in my head a lot. I think legal language is fully complicit in how we think about time and how time is used to punish, oppress, leave people behind, kill people, in fact, right? And that's very evident, like in some, you know, some of our common language around like people being in prison and doing time and all these other things. But for me, a person who has like been in court, had to utilize precedent and all these other things, language and time is weaponized against people so much within the legal system, like in very everyday nonchalant ways, because that's how the law is constructed. And so like, again, even like drawing on this idea of precedent, that what has happened before, what has been ruled before, has to rule in the present day, or also just like language having us think that something that occurred in the past is past. It cuts off at a certain point. It cuts off because it's confined within a particular date and time. But like, we have no language for like how those harms extend into the present, how those harms continue. And so like, even what you said about like, yeah, my generation, or like, I wasn't the one who enslaved you, but you're not only are you still benefiting, the harm is still occurring. Like you are still doing the harm, right? Like in that part, that piece of it is really hard for people to grasp because of how harm has been constructed also in our society, as like, it has to be openly violent, or it has to be physically happening in this way. And I think more and more we're starting to understand like systemic harm and structural harm and how that shows up, right? But it's a very slow going conversation, and it's a very slow going narrative shift in terms of like how we have to think about violence and harm being beyond the physical. And again, yeah, the way that language not only things that, again, drive our lives, it sets us up for thinking that, again, the past is the past, the present is here. We can't access or see the future unless you are a powerful person, right, who can dictate what the future is going to be and then apply that to the present, right? So like, yeah, language definitely sets us up for failure in a lot of ways. And that's why I look at in my book a lot etymology, like sort of the breakdown of language. What are the assumptions that are going into the things that we're saying that carry all these things, even though the word itself may only take on a certain meaning? And then pulling in other language from other places, thinking about how in particular African on the continent, in countries and societies, right? Like certain words for time already link back to the past and link back to the present or the future, right? And so just, yeah, language and etymology is very important.
Listen to a discussion on race, colonial time, and Black freedom with artist, culture producer, writer, community activist, and lawyer Rashida Phillips of Black Quantum Futurism. The music in the background is Bridge Through Time by Lonnie Liston Smith. You listen to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
So you talk about the other projects that kind of really help set the framework for the systematic approach to putting the book together, even though you talk about, you know, this nonlinear knowledge production in the chapters and that you can read any chapters. But there's thinking in a very extensive way in nonlinear, which is interesting because we're talking about a decolonization of the way that time materially arrests us, but also non-materially arrests us. in that question, once you add race in the context of time, because this is what you're dealing with, how does race in the context of being created as a tool of oppression, at the same time is being used, yeah. Simultaneously. And I'm also thinking, specifically about, Black quantum futurism as a project that's feeding into this book, the work that you're doing there, because you're thinking theory, you're thinking practice, you're creating in many different ways, your work at CERN. All of these things are informing. You talk about Black quantum futurism, you talk about the Afrofuturist affair, you talk about that, but was there anything else that you didn't put into the book? Now, this is the conversation, is it something that you, as you read this, because as someone who writes, you always think about, I should have added that, but I'll save it for the next, was there something that you thought about after you wrote that informed your work, our Black, in the context of kind of creating the structure of the nonlinear knowledge production for this book?
There were definitely things that did not make it into the book because it's long as hell already. And it was like even longer. Actually, I had to actually cut off a whole chapter. So I would say there are things that I wish had made it into the book that would have maybe added to the conversation. I tried to like add in snatches of the things that got taken out. And there are ongoing things that I'm learning, right? That, when you're making a book at a certain point, you have to like cut it off, like in terms of like what you're putting into it, what type of, you have to separate yourself from it because otherwise you, or at least for me, like I do feel like full of like regret or just like these things. But yeah, there's ongoing things that I've been engaging in since the book had to like stop being written. That, will make for a second book. So like, for example, and I do touch on this a little bit, like I said, in the book, my partner and I, as part of Black Quantum Futurism, did a tour of the Confederate state, or about seven of the Confederate states, original Confederate states, where we went to different plantations, we went to different all Black towns, different community spaces that were created by Black folks in those spaces, to really be able to do site studies of like time and how time was thought about, created in each of those spaces. And so I did touch on that, some of those experiences, but like I would have wanted to like write a lot more about it and write a lot more about like in the American context, what are our tools of temporal liberation, temporal resistance, temporal resilience, whatever words you want to use. So yeah, forthcoming in another book. And then the chapter that I cut out was about time travel. And so I did an analysis of a bunch of different time travel films, both like with white characters and from like white perspectives of time, white supremacist perspectives of time and time travel. And then thinking about what those things look like in a Black context. And so looking at Black literature, Black films that depict time travel and temporal dislocation, and then just doing an analysis and comparison. And as a time travel nerd and writer, like that was like one of my favorite chapters of the book, but I think it has a place elsewhere. And so hopefully that'll be forthcoming as well.
There's two, again, we probably can talk, there's so much that, again, I appreciate the nonlinear process because, I mean, as I was mentioning to you before we started, like sometimes my students get and other people get so frustrated with me because I end up, at Z before I get to B, all, and eventually I tell them it eventually comes back around. But there's two sections, there's two components of the conversation I do want to kind of touch on. When you mentioned this notion of temporal autonomy, I love that particular concept, and you talk about it's your relation and the foundational aspect of a conceptualization or theorization of space-time mattering. And then you add race into that. So you talk about Black space-time mattering. Could you talk a little bit more, about this level of really self-determination at a very, very visceral, at a very, very deep level? We talk about being liberated from the structures of colonialism, those clear, and Gugiwati Thiong'o and other people talk about, the decolonizing the mind. But this notion of temporal autonomy seems to me as a very all-encompassing way to think about liberation, not only in a structural sense or the material sense and non-material sense, but how they really have conversation and interweave, that once you get free from one thing, you still have to move. You know, it's this constant process of temporal autonomy, as it seems to me, is a constant process of freedom, liberation. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, that concept? You talk about it in the book, but just, you know, just some brief comments on how you were thinking about putting these conceptualizations together.
Yeah, so part of it is, as you said, just taking, one, seriously, the notion that things are co-constitutive. I never know how to say that. Co-constitutive, co-constitutive.
We'll take it all.
That things don't exist in isolation. And I think that is what linear thinking has bought us, what binary thinking has bought us, right? Like that it has to be one way or the other. It has to be this thing or this or that thing. And that separates us, that makes us these like very separate beings and entities that don't, you know, only when we interact, then a thing happens. Instead of saying like, we are only here, like Black only exists because white exists. You know, space only exists because time exists. These things constitute each other. They are interminably entangled. Like there's no way you can disentangle these things because they create each other. And without one, you won't necessarily have the other. And not in contrast, not in a way that like they are against each other, but that they make each other. And I talk about this a lot with light and darkness and how those two things co-constitute each other. They're not separate things, and how we have come to think about it has impacted how we think about darkness and Black people, right? Like those things are so intertwined. Even when we're talking about, oh, time, and I have to stop myself with language around this, like times are dark, or like thinking about darkness as this like very negative thing, right? And that's why, and it impacts how we see things, like because we can't see a thing and it's dark, right? Like it's considered bad. It's considered, and that's because we rely on vision so much. So, right, like it is, when I talk about Black space time mattering, it is all encompassing in the way that you described. Like it has to be down to the DNA level when we're talking about autonomy and liberation. Like it can't be this very surface consideration of like, oh, I have the choice to do this, but not the choice to do that, right? Like it is fully encompassing. It requires the mind, it requires the body, it requires all these things. And that these things are entangled ultimately. Ultimately, our race is entangled with how people think about time. And I go into this in detail in the book around, like, you know, when they were first colonizing Africa and Australia, right? Like it was all about time. The way in which they were able to get to these places was mediated by being able to read the time accurately. When they got there, they categorized people, right? Like your humanity is based on how you spend time, is based on how you relate to time in this way, right? And so they were literally categorizing people as savages if they perceived that they weren't spending time or valuing time in a way that Europeans were when they came over to invade the continent. So it's all interconnected. And so Black space time mattering, like that word altogether, right? Like really, it's very intentional. And I talk about physicist Karen Berard, who, developed the space-time mattering theory for quantum physics, and how it, again, applies in society. For me, that is mediated by race as well. And again, the way in which race constitutes how we see reality, or our perceptions of race and perceptions of skin color and culture and all these things mediate. And in doing so, right, it shifts what's possible. If we believe that only certain things are possible because of certain things or certain people or certain types of people, then it limits ultimately what we can experience and achieve in reality. And I talk about this again on a sort of the cosmic scale in terms of Black holes, but it's like our way of thinking about Black holes, darkness, information, how information spreads, right, is very based on linear Western white supremacist ways of moving through the world. And so it limits our possibilities up to the cosmos, you know, not only on Earth, but up into the cosmos of like what is possible, what we see, what we think is real, all those things.
Just as a quick note, I sometimes I go on deep dives on, podcasts that deal in quantum physics and stuff. And one of the things that always kind of is perplexing as they're thinking about some of the foundations of knowledge of how they understand they don't even touch in African indigenous ways of understanding the world a lot of times. So they talk about it and it's almost like, you know, it's almost like literally either a blind spot or an intentional not talking about it, an inclusion of the way that Africana people understand the worlds that we live in and the worlds beyond. Because, of course, they put that into superstition and other, you know, particular ways of understand, you know, as they say, is not human or not in the context when you're talking about, you know, the way Europeans understand it, the settlers and the colonists. So I'm very interested. You could respond or not respond. So as we come to a particular close, there's two chapters I at least want you to just at least, you know, give our listeners just a little bit, not too much, because, of course, you really map this out in the book. But chapter four is one of them where you write, you know, it's called Time Zone Protocols, which is dealing with the geopolitical history and implications of global time zones. And you mentioned this in your comments to our conversation right now, but you're talking about 1884, you're talking about 1885. Could you talk a little bit more about what is it that you would like readers to get from that chapter if you, you know, if you would give elevator speech or two or three sentences? I know it's hard because there's a lot here. I don't want to minimize, because there's a lot, and I hope people really, you know, take their time with this work. But yeah, chapter four.
Yeah, I think the thing I would say to sum up that chapter is that all time is political and all time is local, and that is really calling back to before we had a global supremacy of time, how time was constructed and thought about. It was based on local communities, local nature, local environments, local ways in which folks interacted and created time together. And it's really like, for a lot of the book, it's not asking folks to do anything in particular except to know this and understand this in terms of how you move and like take from it what you will. Like, I think there's a lot of different things you can do to like respond to how time is global supremacist, but the first point is awareness. And I think that's the step that I'm on, of like, be aware of all of these like politics undergirding simply what you're reading on the clock. Be aware of how that's impacting your body, how it has impacted history, how it has impacted possibility for different communities in particular, and that there are options, right? Like, they're not easy answers at all. Like, it is not easy to think about, like, how do I shift a time zone, or how do I get rid of daylight savings time, or how do we get rid of a time zone for our country or whatever? How do we return to a local sense of time that could support our local organizing or support our ability to create our own community or our own Black town, all Black town or whatever? So it's really awareness and possibility is what I would sum up for it. And yeah, all time is local, all time is political.
Entry points into the imagination, right? Entry points into really thinking about how to construct a free world or liberation.
Yes.
Chapter six, one of my interesting, I liked the title when I first read it. I was like, oh, wow, this is very interesting. And I immediately called back to Nina Simone when she's talking, I think, when she's singing Mississippi Goddamn, this notion of waiting, right? So the chapter is titled Waiting, Waiting, and Waiting Time. Talk a little bit more, you know, about what is it that you would like for, because you talk about, you know, the exploration of the social political mechanisms of control through the concept of, quote, waiting time. And that is waiting, W-A-I-T-I-N-G, time, as a distinct form of temporal oppression. Nina Simone, again, when I'm hearing Nina Simone talk about this or sing this in her song, I'm also thinking about Freedom Now Suite by Max Roach and Abby Lincoln. I'm thinking about those expressions and how you're really providing, you know, really the bones or the skin around the bones that were kind of created in a particular moment. And how does that look today? What are we waiting for? What are we, you know, as someone who's engaged in a lot of organizing, there's this instance that's, you know, what is happening on our campuses? What are happening with our students? What is happening with this clear oppression, this waiting time, and, you know, this type of thing? I'm sorry, but this will be our last, like, little point. We'll pause. Maybe we can have a part two. But What is your what would you like for folk to, this chapter six?
This chapter emerged, it actually was a blog that I wrote some years ago as Juneteenth was starting to become more popular in the common language, like more folks were learning about what Juneteenth was. And I had always wanted to write about Juneteenth ever since I've been thinking about time as like this very specific form in which time or way in which time was weaponized against enslaved Black people, right? And so by forcing them to wait longer. And then the more I did that research on that to write that, the more I was like, all right, this didn't just happen in this one place, right? Like it was different forms of waiting because the law, the legality of the amendments and all that stuff like happened at different points in time. And so like everybody wasn't freed, the next day on January 1st, like everybody wasn't free. Everybody wasn't able to walk away. And even then, even if they were deemed liberated or emancipated, they still had to deal with systems of sharecropping. They still had to deal with enslaved masters and terrorists who did not want to let them go, who literally physically kept them from leaving plantations or couldn't go anywhere because, right, like they didn't have anywhere to go because everything has been taken from them and they have no legal rights to be anywhere. So just the different ways in which waiting was forced on us, weaponized against us, and then just like that juxtaposition to CP time where we're supposedly always late, right, and like always having to make other people wait, right, like and the condition. So just like wanting to trouble those things, but then also to say that waiting in its different form has also been a tool for us, has also been a technology to make other people wait and to, or to like rest and wait or to like wade in the water, right? Like has also been a means of liberation or getting us to liberation or a means of escape or a means of resting when we needed to rest. And then I talk about the weight of all of those things, right? Into the present. And so the last form of waiting is around the like physical weight of time on Black bodies, Black people. And I talk about that in the context of the George Floyd murder, the uprisings that happened after that, the pandemic, and the way those things converged to put even more weight on us, right? And to connect us back to those things of the so-called past that have historically kept us waiting for liberation. And so thinking about like curfews and the ways in which time again was weaponized against us with curfews, with these things during these uprisings, to continue to criminalize Black people, kill us, keep us out of our homes, all those things. And so yeah, it's that juxtaposition, that entanglement of what it means to wait. And both that it is very nuanced, right? It is not a like straightforward thing. Like waiting is feels like it's bad, right? But it can be weaponized both against us, for our liberation. And again, the way those threads continue into the present so that we can't even meaningfully create a distinction between past, present, and future if we see it as entangled, if we see it as a tapestry of things that, are always present for us.
And I just wanted to, as we come to a, I don't like to say close, but as a pause moment, you said entanglement, multiple times. Shout out to our friend and your partner,
Yes.
Irreversible Entanglements,
That's right.
Luke Stewart. Shout out to them and your partner doing it. We have been talking about dismantling the master's clock on race, space, and time. Rashida Phillips, thank you so much for offering this work, offering this genealogy of work, because this is. There's other work that you've done. There's other work that you're going to be doing, and out of this, we look forward to another opportunity to discuss the evolutions of what you have provided for us thus far, and what is it that we can use to as a tool for our liberation moving forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. A lot of gratitude and yeah, looking forward to being in further community and conversation.
You've just been listening to a discussion on race, colonial time, and Black freedom with artist, culture producer, community activist, writer, and lawyer Rashida Phillips of Black Quantum Futurism. Among many things, the conversation between African Owls executive producer and co-host James Pope and Rashida Phillips explored where how space and time are intertwined in African peoples worldwide, what tools to use to actualize theories, and more. You can visit the full conversation on African Owl's SoundCloud page. That's African Owl Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is The Message Continues by Nubia Garcia. That's it for African Owl for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shayan Aina with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, with a particular focus on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and which is followed by Combit La Kai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. And Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW, and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Malcolm X by Mir Makeba as we commemorate Malcolm X's 100th birthday, which was on May 19th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Everybody seems to be preaching revolution. Oppression. That's it. From day to day, Malcolm lived for liberation. Yeah, yeah. Until that man with a gun took away his devotion. Yeah, yeah. He left his wife and kids without protection. Do you remember? Do you
for Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Marathon hearings all night long in the House as the GOP's grinding out last-minute deal-making to shore up wavering party support for President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, a multi-trillion dollar tax breaks package that would slash Medicaid benefits from as many as 13 million Americans before Memorial Day weekend. They're using procedures that could enable approval without a single Democratic vote as soon as today. Democrats are united in opposition. Here's California Congressman Pete Aguilar, Democratic caucus chair.
In the dead of night, House Republicans are working to ram through their agenda to kick millions of Americans off of health insurance and to take food assistance from families who need it most.
Here's Jody Arrington of Texas defending the GOP bill.
Only in the mind of a Democrat would keeping illegal immigrants from receiving taxpayer-funded social services so that we could sustain those programs for American citizens now and into the future could be a scam or trash.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates between 11 and 13 million Americans would lose Medicaid health coverage under the bill. Despite President Donald Trump's push to get hardline conservatives on board with it, the opposition remains due to the estimated $4 trillion debt. The tax cuts package would add to the nation's $36 trillion debt. After calling for steeper cuts to Medicaid, they're now calling for the elimination of green subsidies in exchange for support of the bill, which would ensure its passage. A clause in the GOP budget would bar state and other jurisdictions from regulating artificial intelligence for 10 years. Political commentator, author, and podcast host Lee McGowan raised alarm of the bill in this video that's gone viral on social media.
They are already building AI police, AI attack dogs, AI systems to sweep in and mine all of our data without regulation. The next 10 years will leave us all at the mercy of AI and its creators. And if AI needs anything, it is more regulation, not less.
A bipartisan group of dozens of state attorneys general have sent a letter to Congress earlier this month opposing that provision. Hospitals in Gaza say Israeli strikes overnight into today have killed at least 82 people, including a week-old infant. This is the United Nations warns it's yet to access the limited food and aid Israel's allowed to enter Gaza after a near three-month blockade. And despite the UK imposing sanctions and suspending trade talks with Israel over the war in Gaza and West Bank settlements, images of skeletal Palestinian children reminiscent of starving Jews during the Holocaust have gone viral on social media. A former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, told the BBC Israel's war in Gaza is close to a war crime. And a leader of the country's center-left Democrats Party said his country is becoming a pariah nation that kills babies as a hobby. Meanwhile, hospital staff at two of northern Gaza's last functioning hospitals, Indonesian and Al Auda, say they've been encircled by troops, preventing anyone from leaving or entering the facilities. Israel's claimed Hamas operates out of hospitals has provided evidence for only some of those claims. The latest siege comes as Israel's pursuing a renewed offensive to force some 2 million Palestinians to the south, where they'll be relocated to foreign countries, a plan decried as ethnic cleansing. A federal judge ruled late Tuesday U.S. officials must retain custody and control of migrants the Trump administration has deported to South Sudan in case he orders their removals are unlawful. District Judge Brian Murphy in Massachusetts ordered an emergency hearing today after attorneys for immigrants said in court documents up to a dozen migrants from several countries, including Myanmar and Vietnam, were deported to the African nation. A man from Myanmar was informed of the deportation only in English, a language he does not speak well, and his attorneys learned of the plan hours before his deportation flight, they said. President Donald Trump announced a Golden Dome space missile defense that would cost billions of dollars, akin to Israel's Iron Dome. Christopher Martinez reports.
Once fully constructed, the Golden Dome will be capable of intercepting missiles, even if they are